Okay, sorry, a couple of minutes late, just starting just now. So, talked a bit about cognitive modelling in general. Henry should have talked a bit yesterday about particularly neural networks as sub-symbolic models. So I'm going to say a bit more today about symbolic models. We started looking the other day also at thinking about things like how do you model particular skills, and in particular I got you to think about subtraction. Okay, so cognitive modelling. Mid-20th century, it was demonstrated that internal mental states seem to be, you know, having a model that takes these into consideration seems to be essential for causal explanations. That is, moving away from the idea of behaviorism and moving more towards a view of cognition as information processing, where we have various sensory processes that are acting effectively as input devices. So the information from the environment is converted into an internal representation. So we have these representations, and what we then do is we can manipulate them in different ways internally and transform them, and they we have then output responses. So there was a move towards building computer simulation techniques that explored these various theories. And if you have a whole bunch of empirical phenomena that you observe, or the data that you collect through doing traditional psychological experiments, then there were questions then about, you know, what models might be the best models that would actually be related to theories, various competing theories. So if you had different competing theories about a particular phenomena, could you build a cognitive model that would help you determine between these theories, you know, which features of the theory seem to be making correct predictions and which weren't? There was also quite a big move at the time as well towards having brain imaging techniques. So as well as looking at, let's look at how we can externally model what we believe is going on in the brain in order then to test our theories about it, and we'll build these external models as computational models. At the same time, people also were using a lot of techniques that looked at the brain in different ways, particularly imaging techniques, and the sorts of things that now have become what we refer to more often as cognitive neuroscience. Okay, so the whole discipline of cognitive neuroscience came out of that side of things, looking to see where various activations of the brain might suggest about cognitive processing. But what we're going to focus on here is more the cognitive modelling, in particular symbolic cognitive modelling. So in terms of, if we look at what traditionally tends to happen in psychology, and even currently happens in psychology, in terms of the relationship between behaviour, process and theory, then we can think of it as being, you have a theory that tries to describe some cognitive process that also tries to explain some behaviour And what you're theorising about is about how that cognitive process might generate that behaviour. So this is like the classical relation between them. If we add in modelling as well, particularly computational modelling, then we're adding a further dimension here. So we're actually saying in terms of the model, whereas the theory might explain behaviour, the model can generate behaviour. The theory might describe cognitive processes, the model is going to simulate them. And the model may implement and relate to generation of the theory, and again you have the same relationship with the cognitive process and behaviour. Now one of the readings, I haven't actually put up the readings for this bit yet, but one of them is the first chapter of a book by Rick Cooper on cognitive modelling. In particular, the research group that he's involved in developed a system called Cogent that I'll say a little bit more about later. But the idea of Cogent was to give you a way of building very simple, the sort of the arrow diagram type box models you typically get in psychology, but to build them as cognitive models, so a whole toolkit for doing that. Certainly, if you carry on in this area when you come to third or fourth year, then there will be some of the courses there will go into more detail on using these sorts of tools and actually get you building cognitive models of your own. We're looking at whether we might make a very simple version of that part of the third assignment, but we're still trying to decide if we can do it in a chunk that's manageable for you in the time that you have. Okay, so the connection is school, basically properties in your tissues that implement information processing mechanisms of the mind, critical to the way it works. Models are very simple interacting units functioning in parallel. Looking at these sort of models as some sense analogues of neurons and neural cell assemblies. And this is sort of stuff that I believe Henry was talking about yesterday, about neural network models. So we're not talking about this today, but just to say that's actually the other school of generally people talk about cognitive modelling, you know, the symbolic school and the subsymbolic or connectionist school. So in the symbolic school, information processing is described in terms of the manipulation of symbolic representations, hence symbolic, where what we might be considering there is what's going on at the neural level is actually of secondary importance, so it's a lower level. And again, in terms of how we think of these things, we can think of these models at a number of different levels. And one of the other readings that I'll point you to is a paper by John Anderson that explicitly talks about how you might have these different levels of description and theorising, and also how you might relate between the levels. So you can have models that are at different levels. It doesn't mean either of them is right or wrong or even contradictory. They're just looking at a different level of process, a different level of description. And in terms of the predictions they make, it will be at those different levels. So when we talk about symbolic models, we're tending to talk much more about high-level models. So both neural and information processing models share the idea that the functioning of the mind is in some sense computational and can be simulated by a machine, in this case computationally. They do differ in their approaches, they differ in their assumptions about what sort of representations you're actually using and the relation between the cognitive model and the brain and, you know, the direct match. Obviously, the lower level model you go, the nearer you might be going to the neural network level, therefore, the more you might be directly relating it to when you go right down to the lowest level models, the neurocognitive science ones, they're directly talking about it in terms of, you know, the brain and what's actually going on there. The higher you go, the more abstract you are from that, and the less you're connecting it directly. You also have various hybrid approaches that try and combine the strengths of both. So they might actually have both connectionist and symbolic approaches within them. Okay, just some comments to make about what sort of things make a good model. And again, if you read the first chapter of the Cooper book, which I will put the reference up to, then this sort of elaborates more on this. So a good model has two critical properties. It's complete. This means it doesn't abstract out of the original the things that are believed to be important. So remember I talked the other day about models being an abstraction. But the question is, which features do you include in the abstraction? So for a model to be complete, it shouldn't abstract out the very property of the original that maybe is in your theory that you're modeling. So for example, if you're modeling moving objects, then in general, friction is a property that shouldn't be ignored. And if you don't include friction in it, your model will not be complete. Unless you decide you are modeling it in an environment that doesn't have friction, so you know, or there's a variation on it, for example, the moon. So it also should be faithful, that is, the abstraction process doesn't introduce new properties that don't feature in the original. So you shouldn't be, in your model, adding stuff that actually doesn't relate to the theory. So, for example, if you have a modeling material, so if you take the, you know, the physical model idea of modeling a building in clay, just because the clay is malleable, bendable, doesn't mean buildings are malleable and bendable. Okay, so that is a feature you don't take across. Therefore, if you did have it, that it wouldn't be a faithful model. And the thing to remember, modeling is always for a specific purpose, and you have to decide what properties are critical depending on that purpose. You know, for example, in some cases, colour may be important, it may not. It depends on, you know, what actually you're actually focusing on in your model, what it is that you're abstracting. Cooper et al. Talk about the A-B divide. Now, this also relates to, remember we talked about Ma in relation to perception, and he talked about the different levels, and he talked about the implementation level and the higher level. So this has some relation to that. What Cooper et al. Do is talk much more specifically and intentionally about the separation of theory and implementation in a model. They talk about the features of a model being divided into those they refer to as above the line and below the line. Above the line means those aspects of the model that are theoretically motivated, and below the line are the implementation details. So in theory, you could have a theory that is implemented as a model in several different media. In terms of the theoretical aspects, they should be the same. In terms of the implementation details, they may differ. But if the implementation is truly irrelevant, then any implementation should be adequate, as long as you are clear which things are in the above the line, i.e. which of those relate to the theory. If your behavior you're looking at doesn't vary over a range of the alternative B assumptions, i.e. when you make change to the implementation, it doesn't change the behavior of the model, then that's good, because you're just confirming there that those assumptions are just implementation details. So again, same way as if you're, you know, the analogy is if you're modeling a building, you could do it in clay, paper, lollipop sticks, whatever. If you're looking at if what your theories are about are flow through the building, and your model allows you to examine those, the features relating to flow would be the theoretical aspects. Whereas the fact you've implemented it either in a different medium, you know, clay, paper, lollipop sticks, whatever, they will be below the line aspects. It shouldn't change what you have. Unless, of course, you model it in chocolate and it melts. You know, then the flow is going to be affected. So actually, that is a problem. Okay, so more on the A-B distinction. As a theoretician, you have to decide and declare which aspects of your model and the way you implement it are theoretically motivated, that is A, and which are implementation details, that is B. And the proportion of these may vary. There may be aspects of the implementation that are undecidable, so you can't regard them as theoretically motivated, but all aspects of A must be theoretically testable. That is, any good scientific theory has to follow the general methodology of science and falsifiability and those issues. So any aspect that you have in A that relates to the theory must be critical to the behavior you're looking at as a whole. So if you have a theory about some aspect of behavior and you're modeling it, that will relate to A. And if you make any changes, then you should be getting changes in the measures and differences in the behavior of the model. if you make changes in A, that theoretically motivated aspects, and nothing changes in the model, then actually, should it be there in the theory? Because you're not getting it reflected in the behaviour. A have criticality properties, that is, they should be falsifiable. So the same way as in, you know, philosophy of science, theories must be falsifiable. So if you can't, if the program can't predict the observed behavior, then that implies that one or more of its assumptions are false. Also, distinct assumptions within the theoretical part of the model should predict distinct behaviors. Again, if you read and follow up the reference on this for Cooper, this goes into more detail. I'm just giving you a quick overview here. But B, that is below the line, which is basically implementation details of your model, have sensitivity properties. That is, they're not theoretically motivated. And in terms of the effects on the behavior of the model, changes in B should have no effect on the program's behavior. That is, there should be this property of invariance. Because it shouldn't matter how you've implemented it, it shouldn't affect your theoretical predictions about the behavior of the model. And it shouldn't be possible to compensate for failures in A by adjustments in B. Okay, so if I make a prediction, I have a theory, I make a prediction, I put it in A, and the only way I can make that behavior happen is by fixing the way I've implemented it, by patching it, then that is not a good thing. You've actually violated that. Okay, there was a lot of early work done on symbolic propositional representations, particularly by people like Alan Newell and Herb Simon. And they looked a lot at things like problem solving. And Sean Ernst looked at things like logical inference and also at problem solving. And although we're not spending a lot of time in this course particularly looking at problem solving, it is an area in which a lot of these early cognitive models were built. They developed an explicit theory of problem solving called the general problem solver. They specified it as a theory, as a sequence of steps that were then performed by a computer program. The sort of representations they used were a propositional representation with various objects, their properties and the relations between them. So for example, the sort of tasks they tried to model were problems like the Tower of Hanoi problem. How many of you know the Tower of Hanoi problem? About half of you. So the idea is you've got three pegs, you've got a stack, and when I describe it, you probably will say, yes, I do know it. You've got three pegs, you've got a stack of objects in decreasing size on the pegs, and your task is to move them all from one peg to the other, but there are certain constraints on how you move it. That is, you always have to have a smaller ring on top of a larger ring. Okay, so it's a particular problem of a particular type, and they were looking at modeling those sort of problems. Other sorts of problems they looked at. How many of you know the missionaries and cannibals problem? Fewer of you. Okay. So the idea here is you have, if I get this right, I think you have three missionaries, three cannibals on one side of a river. You want the missionaries to get to the other side of the river. You have one boat. Only two people? Two people can go in the boat at any one time. And what you have to do is ferry all the missionaries across to the other side without them getting eaten. If at any time there are more If at any time there are more cannibals than missionaries on one of the banks, then the missionaries get eaten. It's two people in the boat, isn't it?
Well, with two, you could just take the two.
Yeah, with three, it's too easy. Yeah, with two. So the thing is, that's right. So basically, the idea is, you know, how do you work it out such that all the three missionaries get across when you've only got two in the boat at a time, such that, so you might say, fine, we'll put two missionaries in the boat, they'll just go across. Oh, damn, the third one just got eaten because we left him with two cannibals. And you have to work out how to solve the problem. And there's a whole bunch of these sorts of problems that they were looking at modelling the behaviour of, and they came up with this program that was a general problem solver for these sorts of things. Now, what you find is that, you know, there are certain things that you can assume, there are certain things that people do that you don't assume that would actually not be what you predict, but what's mostly interesting about his work is they came up with representations that you could use and other people later used in building cognitive models. Okay, in terms of if you have a symbolic representation that you're using as part of a cognitive model, they are usually systematic if they consist of a number of parts, and you can replace some part with another part of the same kind and it would still be meaningful. And they're compositional if there are a number of parts and the meaning of the whole is a function of the meaning of the parts. So you basically put them together compositionally. So if you have representations that are systematic and compositional, they can be manipulated by rules, and these depend on the form of the rules, not the meaning. I.e., you can manipulate the objects, you can change things, you can rewrite things. The same way as you think about when we were doing simple grammar rules, okay? When you have grammar rules, you have a rule that says rewrite a sentence as a noun phrase and a verb phrase. Rewrite a noun phrase as a determiner followed by a noun. Now, these are simple sorts of rules that fulfill these properties. And these are the sorts of representations we might be talking about here. Now, in particular, the sort of representation that has typically been used in these symbolic models is something called a production system. So this is the general framework for expressing symbolic models. The idea here is you have a store of propositions. These are things that you might think of are said to be true about the world. So, for example, in the missionaries and cannibals problem, one thing you want to represent is the initial state of the world, and that may be three missionaries, three cannibals are all on one bank and so's the boat. So you'll have a symbolic representation that represents that. And then as you manipulate it, so what you do in that case is you apply operators to it. So one operator is to move people in the boat from one bank to another. That will be an operation. And in that you'll have various arguments, that is, who's being moved and whether you're going left, right, or right, left. So they're the sorts of things you'd be representing in that problem. So generally in a production rule model, you have a propositional store, which you might think of as a bit like working memory. And these are referred to as working memory elements. And that's sort of an analog of working or short-term memory, which we'll talk about more when we talk about memory. You may have a rule database, which is sort of the production memory. These are the rules. These are the reasoning rules that you apply that correspond, in some sense, to a bit of an analog of long-term memory. And then you have conflict reduction, resolution procedures. So if you're saying, well, okay, I've got three missionaries, three cannibals, the boat on this side, I have an operator that allows me to move people, then I could move one person in the boat, or I could move two people in the boat. That's the only choices I've got. I can't move no people in the boat because the rules say you have to have a person in the boat. I can't move three because it says you're only allowed two. So if it's the case that I've got two rules that I can apply, which do I choose? So what you have is, if there are more than one rule that can apply, you have to have a way of deciding which one to choose. When we come to looking at a simple model of subtraction, I think it will become more evident what I mean by this. But the basic idea is, so you have your working memory store, propositional store, your database, that is the rules that you can apply. And what you do is you go through a cycle of phases of recognition, that is, what rules can be applied here, and then acting. Let's apply the rule. So if you've got no missionaries left on the bank, you cannot apply the operator to move anybody because there's no one there to move. If you have six, then you can apply 2 or 1. And then you act, you do so, and in doing so, you change the representation. So if you move two cannibals from one side to the other, you have to change the state of the world. There's now three missionaries and one cannibal on this side, and two cannibals on this side, and the boat is on this side. So what we're doing is we're changing our representation of the world by applying rules, by applying operators. When the thing terminates is when there's no more rules that apply. So we'll go back to looking at the task I gave you the other day. So the other day I said, think about how you do subtraction. think about what the model in your head, and if I said to you, I want you to describe this as a set of rules that can be applied. Now, if you remember, I gave you different examples, and in some cases, the first one, you know, most of you said, fine, that's okay. I'm going to go from right to left. If the top number is greater than the bottom number, I use my number facts, subtract one from the other, and I write the answer below. Then I move to the next column left until I run out of columns left. Okay, you did it slightly differently for B. You use a different number fact for maybe C and D. But when it comes to E, then you have to know a different rule. You have to know the rules of carrying, borrowing, and carrying. So that was where you had to say, okay, I can't apply the rule, the production rule, take the smaller from the bigger if the one below is bigger, so I have to then instead do the borrow rule. The borrow rule, some of you will know as add 10 on, both of them are by add 10 on to that number, and in the next column, add one onto the bottom. Some of you may do it by take one away from the top. Yeah? How many of you do it by adding on to the bottom? How many of you are doing it by taking away from the top? So it's about half and half. Were you even aware there were two different ways of doing that? No. Okay. So you actually have been taught different procedures for this. And some of that may depend on where you were brought up. And actually what happened in the States, when people were looking at cognitive models of subtraction, one of the things that people asked were, actually, which is the best way to teach this? Do you think it's better, and it may seem trivial, do you think it's better to have to add one onto the bottom when you're doing it or take it away from the top? Well, it depends also on when you get zeros involved. So when you get zeros involved, you know, the game changes a bit. You need another rule then for working out what you do when a zero is involved. Now, what actually happened in the States is they ended up with a big research project where they built cognitive models of subtraction that both learnt to learn to do subtraction from scratch using both methods, and that also then applied that. And what they did was they then looked at those and they actually worked out sort of a load factor. It's like what was the cognitive load of doing method A, learning method A? What was the cognitive load of applying method A once you'd learnt it? And the same with method B. So you can imagine, you could think about in terms of what ways might you measure the cognitive load. Well, it could do it in how many productions fire, how many things you have to carry in memory at once. So there could be all these different things you could measure. But this was a serious research project because they wanted to decide what was the most efficient way of teaching it. Okay. What they actually came to the conclusion in the end was one of those two was actually less load to learn, and the other was less load to apply. Okay, so it wasn't a result that they could come up with a clear answer on, and I don't remember which way round it was on the two, but you know, the research is out there. But so people have done this stuff of taking these, what may seem like quite small, you know, why would you build a model to do that, you know, quite intense, detailed models, that they've then said, okay, let's really closely model this, and then let's look and see if there are implications for it. Now, the models they built, when I asked you to talk about it, I said, we'll make some assumptions here. We'll assume that you have number facts. We'll assume that you can read. We'll assume you know how to write down the answers. So I'm taking all those things out of the equation when I was saying it. But if you were building a cognitive model, if you really wanted to test which was more efficient, you would have to also model all those things as well. So the sorts of models people have built have tried to include, you know, a much broader range of the skills involved in it. Okay, so now I'm going to give you another little example to do. So again, this is about getting you to think of what might be going on in the mind of someone else. Now, this is the case where there are four different problems there. You're the teacher. You have set those problems, and four different children, S1, S2, S3, and S4, have come up with answers to those problems. Now, I want you to think about it in terms of the model you had of how you do this. If you think of it as a procedural model of what you did in terms of the borrowing, the taking away, the paying back, And you think of it, these are children who are just learning this skill, so they may not have the complete model. They may either have an incomplete model or what's called a buggy model, that is an incorrect model. So I want you to spend a few minutes, and feel free to talk to each other on this, coming up with theories about what models each of those students is using and what might be missing or incorrect or whatever in their model. Okay, so I'll give you a few minutes on that. When you think you've worked out all four, stick your hand up. How many of you are fairly confident on S1? Okay, just carry on with the others. How many of you got a theory for S2? Any of you got a theory for S3? Okay. Anybody got a theory for S4? Okay, right, S1. Anyone want to suggest their theory for S1?
I think it simply subtracts from bottom to the top when it's impossible to subtract from top to bottom.
Okay. How many of you got that? You just basically take the smaller from the bigger. Okay, so if you were representing that as a production rule model, you'd have the rule that says take the smaller from the bigger, but you'd be not representing whether it's the higher or the lower one. Or if you think about how a child learns, which do you teach them first? Well, you teach them examples where you don't have that problem. So you start off with examples where they can always take the smaller from the bigger. And then suddenly they come across an example where that doesn't work. So maybe a good strategy, what do you do? Well, good strategy, do what you know. You know, just stick with the simple rule you have, take the smaller from the bigger. And if you look at the sorts of errors that children make, that's exactly what they do, that's exactly what happens. You know, people have built cognitive models of that, of actually that stage. Okay, what about S2? So they've learned borrowing, but they haven't learned about paying back. Okay? Again, in terms of the sequence you teach them, that makes sense. So the problem is they've got an incomplete model there. They've got the rule about borrowing that says add 10 to the, you can't, this is smaller, this is bigger than the one above. Oh, well, I'll borrow 10. Right, I can do it now, but they don't know to pay back. And that's totally consistent for S2. How many of you got that? Half. Okay. S3. Yes, that's how the S3 theory.
He does the same as in S1, and he also aligns the numbers to the left. So C is 164 minus 370.
Okay, how many of you got that? How many of you are still stuck? Be honest. Yeah. It's actually one where a lot of people spend a lot of time going, is it the forgetting? Is it the paying back? If I'm thinking of the model in those terms, which bits of the model can I put together? Which bits of the rules can I put together? And then you think, I gave you a clue the other day, in fact, because you said in the first one the other day, I'm working which way? Left to right. That was the clue. Which way do you teach children to read? Left to right. Which way do you teach them to do arithmetic? Right to left. Is it silly of them to try and apply left to right to arithmetic? Not really, when you've just been teaching them reading that way. But a lot of people, if you show them that example, it doesn't occur to them that that may be what's happening there. Okay? So it's exactly the same as S1, but they're just working left to right. And then when they come to one where there's a number left, they go, fine, nothing to take away from that, I'll just put it down. Okay, what about S4? Who has a theory for S4? Yep?
He's just very bad at maths.
Okay, that's an interesting speculation. S4, you think, is very bad at maths.
At arithmetic, like, but because there's no pattern.
Because there's no pattern, they're bad at arithmetic. Okay, you are a shopkeeper. This child is working for you. Which of the four students would you rather have when they're giving change?
S4.
S4. What do you think S4 can do that the others can't?
Return the number. I mean,
broadly, what knowledge does he have that the others don't seem to have?
Rounding up the numbers.
Anyone? Yeah?
Subtracting means that you take away something from the number.
Yes. They have, S4's got the idea. Okay, S4 understands what the process is about. You know, S4 understands what subtraction means. You have a bigger number and you take stuff away and you end up with a smaller number. Yeah, I haven't got the details right, but I'm in the ballpark. Right? The others are all trying to apply procedures and not really understanding what they're doing, but they can follow rules. But if you give S3 £1.87 for something that costs 99p, he's going to give you £8.17 change. Okay? That's not good. S4 is guessing. But actually, they have better knowledge than the others. So one of the things you also have to think about is, can I assume that there are regular procedures here? Actually, when you are teaching, or when you do teach the way you're, generally people do tend to make systematic errors of these type. And when you are teaching, you do want to focus on the procedures, but you also shouldn't forget, you know, what is the enterprise about? What is it they're doing? What is it actually I'm trying to get them a model of? So they have, S4 has a better model of subtraction, but a poor model of the actual procedure. Whereas the others have different degrees of complete models there. Okay, so if you were building a cognitive model of these learners, you said, right, I want to build a model of subtraction in order to help teach people to do it. And, you know, people have done this. People have done quite a lot of model building, particularly if you look at the work at Carnegie Mellon University. They've done a lot of work on intelligent tutoring. They've built tutors that build on a cognitive model of learning that they then use as part of a tutor that then enables them to try and infer what mistakes a learner is making in order then to give them feedback and help them learn to do it correctly. And there's a whole bunch of tutors they've got out there. So that was just the answer. Okay, there was actually some work done on this by Young and O'Shea, and that's actually Tim O'Shea, the principal of this university, who used to be in artificial intelligence here before he went away and did a whole load of other stuff. So he has actually, it's one of the things he's done and knows about, cognitive modelling of these sorts And it was a model that he and Richard Young built. Production model was one of the earliest models of subtraction and multicolor subtraction. And the models they built could account for a large percentage of errors that were found in practice. That's frequently what you're trying to do. Are you able to account for the errors children make in order then to use that in understanding their problems in teaching? And it worked by having production rules, and what you did was delete parts of the rules to get like what you might call the perturbed models that then were able to model the children's behaviour. And the hypothesis that many errors arose from forgetting a subcomponent of the skill or not having learned a subcomponent of the skill. So these are the skill-based models. So the sort of example you might have is a production rule here. So a very simple production rule model, you might start out with three rules. The first rule says, if this condition holds, take this action. Okay? So if the goal is process the column, and the minuend is greater or equal to the subtrahend, and they're the technical names for the upper and lower bit, okay, then take the positive difference between them and write it in the answer space. Okay, that's the production rule for that step of the procedure. If the goal is process the column and the minuend is less than the subtrahend, so it's the other way around, push the goal borrow onto the stack. So what you have is, at the bottom left, you have a goal stack. And the goal stack is a representation of what it is, what's the goal that you're focusing on at this point. So you might start off with the goal being process column. If the goal then becomes borrow, which you've got from applying rule two, then the action you take is decrement the next minuend by one and add 10 to the current minuend and delete the current goal, which means you borrow, you pay back, and you're done on borrowing. Okay? So, if you apply it, you then get this. Oh, actually. So we have a problem here that even though I changed the slide, it isn't appearing in the picture here. Hang on just a second. That's annoying. Okay, so it looks like it's an error in my slides. What actually happened was I changed it, but it's not appearing. Okay, so what happens at this point, if you apply rule one, then the number one should be written below the nine and the eight, and the star moves to the next column, yeah? And because S1 was the only rule that was applicable, it fired. You move on, and you change what's on your goal stack, and S1 is still the only applicable production. The problem is that this rule set isn't adequate. So you have to amend it. So one of the ways you build these models is you come up with an initial model, you try it, so basically you try it, you see if it accounts for the cases, if not, you extend it, you add further rules. So in this case, you actually have to ask, are the answer spaces empty? And if you've actually filled them, if the answer space is filled in, that's when you move left. So again, you have to decide what level of detail of the behavior you're using to describe in the model. And again, so it has appeared here. Right, so here what happens is, if you apply it with a new rule set, then what happens is the one appears. Now, at this point, there's two rules that you can apply. So you have to decide which one to apply. And this is where it's saying about, actually, you have to choose between which rule. So you have heuristics like you say, okay, I won't fire the one that I've most recently fired. I'll fire a different one. So you fire the next one, and S4 fires, and you get to the point where there are no rules left, so it's done. I'll let you look through the slides after when I put them up and just work through this yourself to be clear on how it's working. But this is a very simple, so we've only got something like, we've got five rules there, and we can actually do fairly simple subtractions with it. But it may not then work for this example. if you, what we haven't accounted for there is, what if it's a zero? How do you take one away from that? So then you have to think, okay, what other rules do I add to make my model more complete? Okay, so what one of the things that people have done that are interested in this area, and particularly interested in these sorts of production rule models, these cognitive models, is that they have actually built various cognitive architectures that they use then to model a whole range of theories that then appear as models. So, for example, John Anderson built the ACTAR model, which is this production rule type model for arithmetic, for subtraction, addition, these derivatives. What's then happened is that model he's built from looking at psychological data, from trying to model that, people have then taken and used that as the core for intelligent tutoring systems that then actually explicitly tutor the children, but based on that model. There's also work done on something called the SOAR model, and that has tended to be much more sort of problem-solving type applications. In addition to this, there's, so I'm not going to go through in detail on these basic ideas, but I'll let you read ahead on them, and we may do some reading on them anyway. So the idea is you're trying to predict behaviour by having an information processing model that's implemented as a cognitive architecture. So there's been work, for example, done on looking at a variety of skills. So one case, there was work done on looking at driving while using a cell phone or a mobile phone. So the model actually was able to implement both those skills at the same time and look at how the interaction of those skills, what they might affect in terms of the driver's behaviour. So there's been ACTAR models both looking at perception and attention, learning and memory, problem solving, decision making, language processing. So a lot of these models out there have been used, you know, for a wide variety of cognitive processes. Now, this is just a bit about how the model works. So basically you have declarative knowledge that sort of specifies more factual information and procedural knowledge. So a quick way to get you to understand this, imagine you're learning to drive. When you first learn to drive and you want to change gear, you're told, okay, the way to do this is you put your foot on the clutch, you put your hand on the gear stick, you then have to move it to the right position, and then you move it in, and then you take your foot off the clutch. There's a whole sequence of actions you learn as steps, and you could describe them. As you become more skilled, this becomes more automated into a procedure. If you're a skilled driver, and I say change gear, you'll just go, and you'll do it. And you won't even think about how you do it. You don't have to break it down into those steps, because each of those steps in the description of what you do has become compiled into one rule that you can just simply apply. Okay, another example, don't do this when you're walking downstairs. Think of how you walk. Okay, think of what's involved in walking. Try and analyze it, try and reflect on it. There's many, many things you do like this that you no longer think about how you do because you've compiled them into procedures that are now automated. You think about in terms of sport, if you're learning to play sport, you learn to play tennis, when you're getting coaching, you break the skill down into the exact movements and how you move, but once you become more skilled, you just make the movement. And it's actually quite hard to think, how do you improve it? If someone's coaching you, which bit of that do I do? How do I reflect on that? Because you've automated it. Okay, so that's just a bit about that. Okay, so the Cogent system, just to say, so Rick Cooper and various other people have come up with this modelling toolkit that allows you to build these simple sort of models, allows you to build a wider range of models in relation to cognitive processing, and we will probably look a bit more at that and some of that in the later in the course, and that's just to give you an idea of what sorts of things are in there. Okay, so I'll stop there for now, and I think we're back to Henry on cognitive aspects of language, I think. I forget exactly which bit.